You're listening to a podcast by the Perennial Leader Project. To learn more, visit perennial.substack.com. Welcome back to In Search of Wisdom. I'm excited to share with you today another episode from our series, The Character Lab. This series is a joint venture with my friend and previous podcast guest, Shane Trotter, author of Setting the Bar. Our aim in this series is to explore what it means to cultivate one's character. In this episode, Shane and I discuss objective morality and the shift toward moral relativism. We explore the role of judgment in ethics and the need for cognitive flexibility. We also get into the provisional nature of moral behavior and our inherent insights into right and wrong. We touch on the tendency toward moral relativism, the need for clarity in virtues, the importance of serving the greater good, and much more. All right, without any further delay, I bring you the wise and gracious Shane Trotter. And we'll get into it here, but I wonder if should give some sort of disclosure. It's kind of like a nerdy philosophical topic when you get into objective morality, relativism, subjectivism, nihilism, these things. It's I was wondering, maybe just as a question, I'm curious your thoughts. It's like we tend to skip over this idea. Like there's a book I like, The Big Book of Virtues or something like that.
Yeah. William Dennett?
It's something like that.
William Dennett, I think.
Yeah. It's like 500 pages or so, or something like that. It's not a small book. Mm-hmm. But it kind of jumps over this idea. It's coming from the perspective that you've already adopted, that there's true good and beautiful moral objectivism is a thing. And I kind of get why. It's a little bit of a tricky topic to get into. But yeah, what comes to mind initially to kick us off?
Well, I think it's important because I think it's especially important now because it's not taken for granted anymore. That idea of that there is an actual objective morality is no longer taken for granted. It's not an assumption that there is a right and wrong or a better or worse, that there are these true virtues. And without that assumption in society, that kind of leads to a lack of connection, leads to a lot of anxiety, a lot of feeling lost, a lot of, rabbit hole of rationalizing each decision that you want to do, like we kind of talked about last time. So I think it's really important to put our thumb on this question, hopefully do it in a way that's really accessible. But because when you just skip over it and take it for granted that, yes, there is virtue, right, wrong, and everything, then you kind of lose half the audience already because they're like, eh. I don't take this for granted, right? That I think it does bear giving a good argument for why you should care about virtues, why there actually might be a right and wrong.
Yeah. And sometimes I think like with a lot of topics, maybe we're on a spectrum in terms of how much we're, really behind it. And there are some aspects where, like, I can fall into maybe a bit of moral skepticism, or I don't know if we'll be able to unpack it. Hopefully, we can, but it gets muddy for me. Like, an example. I was trying to think of how do I explain this, but. You know how there's the idea that it's like it's neither good nor bad. Say in Stoicism, this idea it's like something happens to you, You know, it's okay. It's, you know, it's not things that upset us, but it's how we think about them.
Sure.
Like there is this like truth to that. That type of thing shows up, the term neither good nor bad.
That's judge. That's placing judgment on like kind of fortune, yeah, is a good way of, you know, I think you can kind of compartmentalize these things.
Yeah.
For example, like, if I, you know, there's an old Zen saying that's fairly similar. It's like, you know, the kids, this guy's son, you know, falls off a horse and breaks his leg, and they're like, oh, that's bad. And the guy says, maybe. And then the next day, like, there's this guy who comes in and is trying to enlist people for this war, and his son doesn't have to go because he has a broken leg. And someone says, oh, what good fortune. And he says, maybe. And, you know, it's back and forth. And so, yeah, when we're talking about fortune, there's this, it's, you know, good, bad, that those judgments are probably not so useful. I think you can draw a line, though, and say, like, when we're talking about ethics or, you know, morality, things your impact on the world around you, then you can say that there's a better and worse, you know. At least when you get more extreme, you can see it's really obvious. Like, you know, should I, when I'm, you know, should I steal this person's car, you know, kill them, steal this person's car just because I want it, or deal with the fact that I don't have the money for this car and I don't have this car, and you know, not kill, yeah, this person for their car. It's like, which is better? It's obvious, yeah, right? So I think that you can draw a line and say, like, okay, fortune is different. You know, speaking about events and fortune, whether it's good or bad, the things that are happening to us in our life, it probably doesn't do a lot of good to say, to judge good versus bad. But when you're talking about ethical decisions, behaviors, you could call them good or bad. You might just say whether they contribute, you know, if you want to get away from ethics, you might even just say whether they contribute to your to human fulfillment or not. Whether they are, you know, positive towards for you know, utilities to society, however you want to look at it, if you were a utilitarian. But, you know, whether they contribute to human flourishing or you know, make human flourishing less likely.
Yeah.
But I think you can make that distinction.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And hopefully we can set up a couple, throughout the conversation, a couple parameters and lines and distinctions and things like that. But even in the way, like, of on this particular point, I love the parable, maybe yes, maybe no.
Yeah.
But the, even in the term of ethics, if you do some sort of ethical transgression against me, for me, neither good nor bad. You know, it's like, and they're coming from the perspective of, it's neither good nor bad because it didn't harm your character. But on your end, like the person committing some sort of ethical wrongdoing, it's not exactly the case. So it's like,
yes,
it's this weird, yeah, that gets like tricky to me in the way of, like you talked about the word judgment, great word, and the Stoics are talking about that in judgment, but there's some sort of, like flexibility in thinking, like cognitive flexibility that is required around this.
Absolutely.
And I've seen a lot of debates, and I've seen, you know, there are many, many people that make the case for some sort of moral skepticism. Like, interestingly, we were chatting before we hit record. I sent you a video by a guy named Kaplan, this philosophy professor, and I found it interesting. He said something, if I heard him correctly, that the majority of his students, like these people that are taking a, you know, philosophy 101 course, he would categorize them as moral, you know, skeptics, or, you know, in this idea of subjectivism, that it depends. And it's I found that interesting, because it's, maybe I'm bringing in too many things here, but even in the thing of like from a Christian perspective, even in the way of some sort of ethical wrongdoing, there's the judgment from another perspective of me not judging you. You know, me, instead of like judgment towards you as an individual, like forgiveness and compassion. Me, you know, the common well-known scripture thing of pointing out the speck in someone else's eye, you know, while there's a log in mine. Yeah. So it gets like these type of things, it gets a bit tricky.
And you're right. Cognitive flexibility is a great word. I actually wrote a Substack post on that very, well, I use a large chunk of it was going into that very verse. Because, you know, nice. And I kind of point out that, you know, just after, you know, comes from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. And shortly after that, Jesus makes the comment, don't judge, you know, take the log out of your eye before pointing out the speck in your whatever. And then, I can't quote as well as many others could. But shortly after that, he says, don't throw your pearls to pigs, which is saying that you need to be able to judge who is a pig. I mean, inherent in that statement is, so he says, you know, literally a line later, he says, don't focus on the speck in your neighbor's eye when you have a log in yours. And then a line later, don't throw your pearls to pigs, which requires you to have the ability to judge who is a pig, who is not going to, basically be able to, it's kind of like the, you're the average of the five people you hang out with the most is kind of what Jesus is alluding to there. So you have to be able to judge who's going to support you in this path or not. So you're right. There's a lot of cognitive flexibility required here. The ability to note that at the same time, I might not want to judge others, but I need to be able to see in others what behaviors aren't fruitful that I don't want to continue and fall in myself. And I need to be able to see in others, like, you're on this path that is very destructive to society. All right. And I don't want to support you in that path. And like, even if I care about you, I might have to, caring about you might be part of caring about you might be helping lead you away from that path. Like, if I care about you, I don't let you steal, you know, because I care about you and I think you're better than that. I'm going to help try to turn you away from that sort of behavior, which requires judgment, which is based off of a sense of moral objectivism.
Yeah. Yeah. On that spectrum, it makes me think of like some of the terms that come up around this are relativism. You think of like cultural relativism, you know, subjectivism, but then like related would be nihilism. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe it's like, sometimes I think of that, pearls and swine idea of like someone that is seeing like inherently evil as the capital G good. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like this different thing in terms of that is a much bigger move from the like seeing, you know, the opposite of this moral objectivism, true, good, and beautiful. There's a lot of movement in the way of going from there, but not so much in the way sometimes of like a cultural relativism or this, you know, subjectivism type of stuff. That, like, to me sometimes is a, could just be just like a slight shift in perspective, like a slight shift in in a way of looking at it to me. I don't know, like any thoughts of like how we get from a subjectivism type of worldview closer to, I hate to keep saying these long philosophical words, but closer to a, let me say, true, good, and beautiful, you know, this time.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, right? Like you said, there's these big words. And, you know, just to clarify for anyone listening, you know, cultural relativism, moral relativism, subjectivism, just to simplify this idea, it's this idea that you do your thing, I'll do mine, you know, but more than that, like, and it's all just as good. Like, who am I to judge you? Who are you to judge me? There's no better and worse. It's really the sense that there is no better or worse. And, you know, I think you have to be able to separate things politically and morally too. Like, you could be a libertarian, you know, who thinks that politically the government shouldn't tell you what to do, but also be like a devout religious person who thinks that, but there is a right and wrong. So the government shouldn't step in to say that, you know, and, but potentially, you know, you should have that compass yourself and work that out with your creator, whatever it is. I think what's helpful is to, you know, to get us there is to see like why society has drifted, as you alluded to earlier. You said that the Professor Kaplan, his assertion was that most of his students were moral subjectivists, meaning they thought that there was no true good and beautiful, basically, or at least not objective beautiful. Nothing that was objectively good. That it was all relative. You know, your choice, your taste. It's basically your morality could be based on taste. And like, who are you to tell me that it is wrong for me to, let's at the risk of coming off very poorly, but who are you to tell me it's wrong for me to have sexual relations with an animal, right? Like, who are you to tell me anything is wrong? It's not hurting you, like, you know. So there's kind of this sense in society, and you know, there's a great book, The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, where he goes through these, and typically university educated students really lean that way, where they lean towards like, you know, he has all these surveys he gave out to his students. For example, you know, one question is, you know, if you and your sister you're both in your 20s and you go off and you, decide that you're going to have relations with each other. You use protection. There's, you know, nothing comes of it. Afterwards you decide that was fun, but you're not going to do it again. And your relationship is not hurt or anything else. Like, is it wrong? And like 97% of university students that he polled were basically said no. And that you know, flies in the face of a lot of like religious worldviews and ethical traditions of the past. So like we've really seen this drift toward moral relativism. And especially, you know, I have an example of that myself. I basically posed a question of how do we know if something's better or worse to a class, a team leadership class, trying to get just a dialogue started. And very, you know, unanimously, the class was trying to tell me there is no such thing as better or worse. And I live in Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which is, you know, the most religious area in the country, I just saw. And like all these students are telling me, oh, no, there is no such thing here as better or worse. I'm like, you know, so if I go punch your baby sister, like, it's not better to not punch than it is to punch a baby sister. So that's kind of what has gone on. And, to go a step further, are you familiar with moralistic therapeutic deism?
No, never heard of it.
It's a really interesting. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was it's at Notre Dame now. I think it was at North Carolina at the time, professor who did a global study calling teens across the nation to give them a survey to figure out what was the most common religious beliefs of the United States. All right. And so he gave them all these tests. And though they all, you know, the majority, like over 80%, claimed to be Christians, through his surveys, he came to the conclusion that they weren't, you know, by their actual beliefs. They claimed to be Christian, but by their actual beliefs, you know, they weren't, in his opinion. They were what he called moralistic therapeutic deists, which basically, as he defined it, was like, they thought that there was a God who wanted them to be happy, and wanted them to basically try to be a good person. But what that meant, that there weren't really any requirements that came with that. So you can see this is kind of a step in that direction. This is the late 90s, early 2000s. And like, so even the religious belief is shifting towards like, like there's not a lot of requirements. Just kind of be nice to everybody. And you know, guess what? There's a God who wants you to be happy and he's going to take care of you. And you can call on when you want something. And, you know, like Santa Claus, he's going to try to answer. And so you can see that step towards moral relativism. Right. And I think that that's the kind of the context that we're bringing this conversation into today, is, you know, why did that shift happen in American society, and you know, Western society more broadly? Right. I think that has to be addressed first, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about it in the way of, you know, this character lab series, you know, half a dozen episodes we're going to do. I'll put a link in the show notes if anybody didn't catch the first episode, which was kind of a broad introduction. But I was thinking about, you know, we have this rough outline that I can't quite remember all the way forward, but the next episode is, you know, Who's Your Socrates? All about role models. But I was thinking about how, like, this idea influences, like, all the rest. You know, if there is no sort of better or worse, like, in the words of, you know, talking with young students and things like that, that's going to influence in the way of, like, what's the need for a role model? Like, what's the need for some sort of, you know, person's life or, you know, highest good? It's just kind of the rest is not even needed. And maybe you could say in the way of character development, what is, you know, is character development a thing without, you know, the notion of true good and beautiful or better and worse?
Yeah, so... And that's a tough one. I wonder, I want to say two things. First of all, Professor Kaplan's assertion, which I tend to lean towards, is that a lot of people claim to be moral subjectivists, but if you question them long enough, no one is.
Was Auschwitz good or bad?
Everyone's got something. And they might, because they know they're in a kind of a theoretical situation, they might give you the answer, well, we can't say whether it was good or bad. But then, like, these same people are going to have their pet issues, and they're going to be morally appalled at you when you don't, you're not sympathetic to the plight of these people, or you don't care about climate change, or whatever it might be. Like, they will have something that they fervently in their, you know, to their very core, believe in and think ill of you that you don't share that belief, right? So and this is, everyone can kind of play that game and see this in their experiences, right? You know, whether someone says they're moral relativist or not, like, they don't actually think everything is just as good. They do make ethical judgments in their day-to-day life. You know, they do decide, like, it's whether, you know, whether their decision is it's bad to spank your kids or it's bad to let your kids, you know, rule the world and do whatever they want without consequences. Like, we all have these judgments deep in our bones. You know, and you can debate where that comes from, but like the reality is, no one in practice is an actual moral relativist. And I think that's important to note. No one in practice is an actual moral relativist. So we are all picking some sort of moral code. And it might be a lot looser with a lot less constraints, but we all kind of have something. So it's worthwhile thinking about, like, if you're going to have one anyway, like, what should it be? And why does it exist? Right. You could say that it's an evolutionary a quirk of evolution, which, you know, Jonathan Haidt in The Righteous Mind goes into great detail on that and kind of makes the case that morality is a human superpower. It is what is allowed, you know, the human species to dominate the world. It is what allows us to cooperate at massive scale. If it wasn't for shared morality, like, then there's no way that humans could have, you know, had civilization as we know it. This is what allows us to kind of have common guardrails and boundaries, so that humans can flourish. A lot of people, you know, on all sides, on all issues, any political issue that you see, they're tending to make a moral argument. Whether that's, you know, we should take care of the future by, you know, being, you know, less dependent on oil and, you know, more carbon neutral, you know, be kinder to animals. Like, these are all moral arguments. Or whether it's, you know, saying like, you know, like, you shouldn't have an abortion in the final term. Like, that's a moral argument. So immigrants should be allowed. They shouldn't be allowed, you know, illegal immigrants. So it's like, it's kind of all over the place there. These are all moral arguments. And I think I'd be curious to hear your opinion. Does it really matter whether there's a real and I have my biases here, but does it really matter if there's a real, like, moral truth, or if it's just like what promotes human flourishing? do you get what I'm saying there? Like, does it actually matter? Because it's really kind of impossible to say. Like, do our intuitions about right and wrong, do they come from a higher being, or are they evolutionarily produced and, you know, irrespective of a higher being? Or is it a combination of the two? You could go all these different ways. At the end of the day, like, if we can't know, if you just understand the function of morality throughout time and how it's been essential to human flourishing, doesn't that mean you should care about it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult thing. Surprisingly, I think a little bit about this in the way of, I think I put a question is like, you know, is character formation really what through much of history, like we called spiritual formation? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, is the adoption of moral objectivism, like there is this like capital G good, around, you know, moral behavior, moral excellence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need to believe in a creator, like that these came from somewhere? And sometimes I waffle on that, but I do think, like, in the way of two options, like, one, because, like, if we are going to adopt that, well, then the next, like, question is, okay, well, what are they? What are those, you know, behaviors that are in the category of moral excellence? Because then you got to kind of drill it down and get a bit specific. But, like, I don't typically think in the way of, like, evolutionary, but, I mean, you could use that word as well. And, like, you know, throughout the arc of history, like, wisdom traditions, like C.S. Lewis uses the term Tao, like, the way, like, across traditions, what are these, the common set of virtues that we all believe. And he says like that it's really a law of human nature. For in this book, The Abolition of Man, which I have a quote that I want to get to from that, which was, I don't know when it was initially published. I can't remember, but many, many, many decades ago.
It was like the 19-teens or 1920s. He was studying the Green Book, which was the educational book.
Yeah. But I was thinking in the way of, so it's like he uses, I think, law of human nature. And he's saying it's just like the law of gravity. Maybe we touched on this last conversation. I apologize if we get a little bit redundant in this, but I think it may be helpful as well to hear some things touched on again. But it's like just like the law of gravity, except we don't actually have to follow it. I was thinking in a way of an analogy of writing, like I put out these like daily emails, and there's specific, like basic, you know, grammar rules. Like you capitalize the first letter in each sentence, to use like a simple example. That's essentially a law. It's a writing rule. I don't have to follow that. You and I could make a pact right now. Hey, we're done with capitalizing the first letter in every sentence. And it's like, we can do that. But it's like, he's making the case in some sort of way. It's like, yeah, there is this way. We know inherently, just like you were talking about, we're not, even though we might call ourselves, and in some aspects, you know, we're moral relativists, but if someone robs our house when we go to work, we generally deem that in the category of that was bad. That was, how could someone do that?
Sure.
And he points to a lot of these things. And I know you have young kids like I do. I notice that in the way of young kids, of they know when there's some sort of unfair act or some sort of thing. It's like we are kind of wired a little bit, and not saying that we can't be influenced towards the direction of darkness and evil, but it seems like naturally we have some sort of insight around, you know, what is good and what is bad around, you know, moral behavior. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I kind of go back and forth. It seems like it's a much easier move in the way of adopting a particular religious tradition, in the way of, you know, this came down, in the way of,
yeah,
this and that, or there's some sort of like creator, even in the way of Stoicism and different like philosophical things, Socrates, Plato. These are people that were, maybe they weren't, you know, Christians, because obviously it's kind of before that time, or, you know, with the Stoics, maybe kind of right around the time of Jesus and things like that. But they are people that believe in God. You know, sometimes it's gods, you know, in the way of plural, but it's like some of this stuff is coming from outside of them. They are not the seeing themselves as the center of the universe type of thing.
Yeah, and that's kind of the argument of C.S. Lewis, right? That these intuitions, they come from somewhere, that all civilizations throughout time have had certain intuitions, and they come from somewhere. They're put in there from somewhere. It's, you know, really a deeply Christian idea that there is a there's a relationship with God. There's, you know, and so that you are able to discern right and wrong through these feelings, through these, you know, this sort of, you know, connection. Like you actually have a conscience that determines right or wrong. That's what he called the Tao. I think, you know, there's kind of different ways you can go here, that people can get lost in. You know, there is a sense of dogma, like, give me the rules. These rules come from on high, right, wrong, like strict binary, like yes or no. And then there's what I think is a better view. If you're just going to like say, okay, I want to entertain moral objectivism, like, and what C.S. Lewis is saying with the Tao, this idea that, you know, like a universal truth that that people have independently come to in many different human contexts without crossing. That would be pluralism rather than, dogmatism, rather than there's this strict like code, like explicitly spelled out right, wrong. You know, there's no gray areas. You know, pluralism is this concept that there are, what Jonathan Haidt would describe as like taste buds. Like, it's not just, salty. Like, morality isn't just like making sure things are as salty as possible. They're not just making sure they're as sweet as possible. They're not just making sure they're as savory as possible. It's this balance between competing moralities, or not competing moralities, competing virtues that are sometimes complementary, sometimes contradictory. And there's like a thermostat, like just a perfect reading for each virtue in each situation. And it could be context dependent and dependent on the person and dependent on, a lot of different things. So there is a right or wrong, but it's really, 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 really hard to discern. And that is like what it means to pursue wisdom. Like, pursuing wisdom is pursuing the capacity to discern right from wrong in each an infinite number of contexts, experiences, scenarios, if that makes sense. It's like sharpening your sense of how do I identify what is good or bad. Is this get into the weeds too much, or is that kind of making sense?
No, I think it's helpful. Let me try to throw a practical example to that in the way of provisional nature, and tell me if this is helpful or not helpful, and add to it. So, like, you go to the local supermarket, and you come out of the supermarket, you're going to your car, you've got a couple bags of groceries, and somebody tackles you and takes your groceries. Neither good nor bad in the way of what I was initially talking about, like from the perspective of my character is unharmed. Mm-hmm. For this individual, well, it was bad. Like, that is not moral excellence that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, I can have compassion, and I can come from a perspective of love, and maybe this person was trying to feed their family, and we just don't know in terms of the situation, and maybe with that parable, is this good or bad? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Whatever it may be. Now, like, from the perspective of I come out of the supermarket, another example, and like somebody is, has somebody at gunpoint or some sort of like unethical act. Somebody's like trying to carjack someone, and I come up from behind and I tackle this individual, and tell someone to call 911 and all of this. So, like, same act. Tackling someone, this and that, but based on the circumstances, two different ways to think about it. And it's like common sense in a way, but it's like it gets to a little bit of like the provisional nature of these things. Like, what is, courageous in what might be considered in the, the virtue of courage in one situation is not in another, and all of that type of stuff.
And just to piggyback on that, like, courage can be running, can be going to the war, can be like running into battle, fighting the Nazis. That was one thing that made World War II a little bit easier to and more unifying than a lot of the wars have been lately. Like, it's really clear. Hitler bad. Hitler really bad. We do need to stop this madman. Like, everyone could unite around that. So courage can be that, running into battle, or courage can be Gandhi. Like, nonviolence. Yeah. Like, literally turning the other cheek. Like, putting yourself in scenarios where you are, it's moral courage. As you said, the provisional nature of this, I think that's well said.
Yeah. I want to touch on something that you said in our last conversation. I love it. The rationalization rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I love that phrase, but it makes me think in the way of like, I kind of want to have some humility and say that, man, sometimes like actually in practice, I lean towards moral relativism in the way of my rationalization rabbit hole that I can go down. And also, like the provisional subjective nature, like this example of coming outside the supermarket, of like all of this, like maybe I don't go tackle and intervene this person that's maybe carjacking someone. Maybe I just mind my business and I go over here. And then I do the rationalization rabbit hole where it's like, should I have done something? You know, my conscience coming in is like, sure. Well, no, it's like, that's, you know, that's that for be fair law to my enforcement kids. Profession.
That would yeah, be yeah. my kids, you know, to put myself at risk. I should never put myself at risk because, you know, you can do that. You can figure out.
Yeah.
You know, good people do this. People who believe in moral objectivism do this all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. But I was thinking like in the way of humility, which obviously may be something that comes up throughout like all of these conversations, but also like the pride. The arrogance of like, well, I'm gonna deem what is right and wrong. I'm not gonna one look to some sort of religious thing, God, or I'm also not gonna look towards, you know, what culture and, you know, evolution, wisdom traditions in general, like C.S. Lewis's The Tao. Well, I'm gonna decide. You know, what is good and what is right and wrong. It's up to me to, you know, determine that for my life.
Mm-hmm.
How do we unravel that, I guess?
Which is really, really, really common, right? Like this assumption that, and I think that's where most, I said it last time, I think that's where most 18, 19 year olds are, you know, kind of at least sometimes fall to, like they're in this position where they're going to be able to decide for themselves what's right and wrong without any external influence, without any, you know, any reading any great books or, you know, looking at any wisdom traditions from different contexts, you know, thinking about what has been a virtue throughout time. Like you tend to fall into like this utilitarian, you know, as long as it doesn't harm others, which breeds the rationalization rabbit hole. Right. You know, and that is, you know, this ties perfectly into, you know, the comment about, you know, when people claim to be moral subjectivists, they tend to have a sense of moral objectivism anyway. And it tends to be tolerance, like tolerance is their dogma. You know, if you are intolerant, well, like, whew, there's nothing worse than being an intolerant person, which, of course, is a lack of tolerance for intolerant people. So, you know, then that's a good way of looking at that. So there are judgments that are going to be made no matter what. In your question, correct me if I'm wrong, is basically like, why would it be better to lean on a wisdom tradition and traditional values and kind of the Tao more or less throughout time, than to allow yourself to be that 20-something-year-old who is a utilitarian rationalization rabbit hole sort of guy. Like, oh, I'm going to figure out in every situation, I'll be able to rationalize. The answer, in my opinion, would be because you will only serve yourself at the end of the day. And that's what you want.
Yeah. And it connects with something I wrote in the way of sometimes when we think about character, serving ourselves, self-reliance, We can think of character as like only doing hard things, you know, like you're no stranger to doing hard things. Mm-hmm. It's like character development is David Goggins, like period, yeah. You know, yeah. Right. Why is it more? Why is it a broader, you know, thing than that?
Like David Goggins is a great example. He does a way into character development is discipline and the capacity to do hard things. I don't think you can have character development without that. Like discipline is like a portal to more. But like everything can be taken to extreme and everything needs to be balanced by other virtues. And, you know, just doing hard things, you know, the Nazis did really hard things. You know, being excellent at, you know, a lot of different, you know, capacities. Well, the Nazis were really excellent at a lot of different capacities. They did hard things. They were excellent at all these things. They were disciplined. Like, what's missing? There's got to be, you know, you've got to be checked by kind of the whole gamut of virtues, I guess, is what I would say there. You know, where that comes from is really the question, right? How do you decide, like, what is the full spectrum of other things to care about? But yeah, like we can all see that the, you know, Nazis, they got up, they trained hard. They were obedient. They were respectful. They did all these things. And yet they did just these atrocious things. So it has to serve something higher. Your discipline, your everything has to be funneled towards a greater good, a sense of what is actually true, good, and beautiful. If it's not serving that, then it's, you know, you could do it at Star Wars, you know, Darth Vader, he was all these things, but he was not, he was on the dark side.
And it seems like we can assume that, say, not just like doing hard things, like committing ourselves to some sort of physical like excellence. But I even think, like, as you're talking about it, in the way of, say, in Eastern traditions, like Buddhist traditions, whether it's like sages that become unbelievably committed, dedicate like decades of their lives to observing the mind and being able to, you know, be liberated from the clinging desire of whatever it may be, and being in the present moment, and still do very horrible things to their students, or in different like Christian traditions where there's like a commitment to whatever it may be. And there's obviously loads of stories of theologians and different people doing very bad things.
They're devout, they're following the rules, and they're not serving the greatest good at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like these different domains where it's like this ethical education, you know, character formation is like requires discipline, requires, you know, all sorts of things, but like is its kind of own domain. Like it's kind of fascinating in the way that, maybe it makes sense when you think of some sort of, you know, examples of, you know, Hitler, like you mentioned, and different things. It's like, oh, it's like evil. But yet you can get these people that have kind of committed their lives supposedly to the opposite, find themselves doing very evil things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like,
yeah,
maybe it connects with the rationalization
rabbit hole
thing coming in, but it's like this thing of relativism, subjectivism, this thing of like, I've heard it. There's a pretty good talk by Jonathan Pageau recently talking about like the highest good, you know, this capital G good, Well, like as we navigate, there's all of these other like goods. It's like safety, pleasure, honor, all these other sort of like, you know, that aren't really goods, but we start seeing them as goods. And, you know, there are things that obviously affect our character. There's things that are, you know, the obviously the opposite of moral excellence can come in. It's like we're easily deluded, easily drawn towards, you know, or drawn away from like the highest good, which gets back to the thing of like clarity of standards, like in the way of if we're committed to some sort of character development, moral objectivism, there is a thing of true good and beautiful, like then, okay, what does that look like? I don't know, like the need for clarity, like in my mind around what are these virtues? What do they look like? You know, forming ourselves and working lifelong project to conform our lives to these virtues, you know, it's a difficult and tricky thing, I guess is what I'm saying. And it's kind of fascinating, you know, that that's the case.
It's endlessly, I mean, it's impossible to know what's best. There's so many things but that doesn't mean that there isn't a best and a clear better and worse, if that makes sense. Like we have a target we're aiming for, and you know, we're never going to hit it, but we're better off for having the target, if that makes sense. Right. Is that kind of, capturing, you know,
I don't love the word impossible, but you know, in the way of, I get what you're saying in the way of, are we going to know with complete certainty? But in the way of some of these, like the evil acts that I'm talking about, without much reflection and with a bit of clarity in the way of your way of life or looking at any, like put a list of any sort of, like we know, like, no, this is like, we know, but it's.
Yeah. Like don't put people in ovens. The ethnicity they were born into. Boom, we got it.
But it's like the humility of it, though, of like, yeah, I may not know for sure what courage looks like in this particular situation, but we kind of know what it doesn't. You know, we kind of know, like, running the other direction or, you know, whatever it may be, like, in maybe we'll get into, I think one of the episodes, maybe, like, on the idea of the common good. Like, we kind of know, does this lead towards, is this an act for the common good running in the opposite direction? Like, we know that that's not it. But it's so difficult in like the fast pace of daily life in a way for moral excellence, but maybe it's not as challenging. And like, just thinking about like avoiding vice, you know, as like a strategy.
Is really hard to know, because there are situations where you don't run into battle, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, true. Where the situation does not call for courage necessarily. It calls for another virtue prioritized over courage. There's another context where courage is going to be prioritized over justice, say, you know? And so like, it's so hard. And that's what I mean by impossibility. Yeah. I don't think it's impossible to make the right decision in any specific case. I think it's impossible to be perfect and always know and have a moral template that is, I can write this. I can't give you a formula that you can then apply to each scenario and like, divide this, this is, okay. So in this, I need, you know, 10 parts courage, 2 parts, two parts wisdom or whatever it is, like all in there all the time. And it's really hard to discern. And yet that doesn't mean that there isn't a right and wrong.
Yeah.
And it's why these discussions and why discussion is so important. And that's, you know, come down in our tradition throughout the ages. It's like the Socratic dialogue. It's why that was brilliant and life-changing is.
Yeah.
Because it is a method of trying to come to truth and trying to overcome the implicit bias that plagues us all. And the, you know, those cognitive biases that you know, we can't ever discover without the help of other people. And so I guess, you know, that's what I mean by impossible. Like, it is impossible to always know. To become perfect. And to see that.
Yeah, it's like the thing of like the pursuit of excellence. You know, it's about the pursuit.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't get into like the toxic perfectionism type of stuff, which is often said as like, that's the enemy of the good. So it's such like a good point of like, it's not about that. Mm-hmm. It's good stuff. Our time flew by. I could talk to you for hours upon hours about this stuff. But as we wrap up, let me read this one passage that I love. I'm sure you've heard and probably many listeners have heard from Lewis's Abolition of Man. He says, "In all time, such as the tragic comedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. You can hardly open a periodical without coming across the statement that what our civilization needs is more drive or dynamism or self-sacrifice or creativity. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst." Love that. Love that passage.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And it's like those very qualities, like as he said, it's like one of those, maybe surprisingly, it's like just like a deep belief in the true good and beautiful, like a deep belief in it. It does to me feel like it's on some sort of spectrum. You know, it's like we can really get that in our bones, like a commitment to the, you know, capital G good, and be really mindful that it's like there are forces that want to compete with it and want to pull it down. And our own human nature leads us to rabbit hole rationalize, go down it.
Yeah. It's this, but he's so spot on. There's this tendency, and I think it's even more pronounced now, like most of what he talks about is much more pronounced now in society, especially post the technology. He's writing before everyone has a television in their house, delivering them, you know, a million advertising messages a day that are, you know, kind of, the, you know, all formed around the idea of, not all, but many formed around the idea of moral relativism. You know, treat yourself, you deserve it. There's, you know, don't let anyone tell you you don't. Like, there's no, you know, don't let listen to the judgment. You know, don't listen to the haters. Like, you deserve this. It's kind of like this underlying ethos of society. And he's writing before that. You know, he kind of saw what was before that. And I think that, you know, a good way of thinking of that, you know, we're treating all the symptoms without treating the cause. We're looking at mass mental health crisis without realizing like the thing that binds community. I mean, we're talking about how people need more connection. They need more friends. They need more. They need all of these things that are going unmet in our world. Like, they need more health. They need more that. And it's like, well, like underneath that all is, it's like the pursuit of what is true, good, and beautiful. If that was still there primary to society, to civilization, to our culture, then like the connection with the people around you would be there in spades. The mental health, if, you know, mental flourishing would be there in spades. And there's a lot of research really to support that. There's a ton of research to support, Jonathan Haidt makes the case over and over and over again that, morality is this human superpower that allows connection, that, and without it, you have individualism, like hyper-individualism, rationalization rabbit hole, the ability to do whatever you want, but the inability to connect, because we connect over common passion, which is rooted in like firmly held beliefs around what's true, good, and beautiful. So I think that's just, what C.S. Lewis is saying, I think is brilliant. And we've seen it, everything he's speaking of has been, we've gotten to a point where it's all been amplified.
Yeah, I love it. That's a great way to wrap it up, Shane. And you talk about a lot of these ideas in your Substack and in your book, Setting the Bar. We'll link it all in the show notes, so it's easy to find for the listeners. But again, man, super grateful for you committing the time to do this. I think this is a really important topic to think about, having like a series of a half a dozen episodes on this similar topic of character development. I'm excited to see, how it turns out at the end and what the listeners think of it as well.
Yes. So
good stuff. Thank you so much, man.
Hey, thanks so much. This has been a blast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the In Search of Wisdom podcast. I hope you found something useful for daily life. If so, I encourage you to put what you heard into practice. If you're interested in more tools for the art of living, consider subscribing to Perennial Meditations on Substack. By becoming a member, you'll help support the project and gain access to our podcasts, meditations, and courses. Until next time, be wise and be well.